I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Monday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That's my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page if you have information, insider breaking news you want to share with me. I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up in the second hour of the show, on a Be Inspired Monday, we will catch up with the host of our new Hour of Power dual inspiration segment. That's Khadijah Ali Coleman and Bathsheba Smithen as well. They're going to be talking about trust in thyself in times of doubt. My Lord, they're preaching. I think a lot of people need to hear that today. Also in the second hour, we'll talk to a young man, Chase Turner. He's a graphic designer and creative strategist of I Chase Art LLC. He's going to be talking about branding, the importance of branding, and it is becoming more and more important as far as business matters are concerned, day by day, actually. So looking forward to both of those conversations. In the second hour, a little bit later in this first hour, we'll be joined by Morgan State University professor Dr. Stacy Patton. Over the weekend, she penned an opinion piece that was published in the New York Times over the weekend in the Sunday section titled Stop Beating Black Children. She will be my guest at 5:30. She has some very personal experience connected to the issue of corporal punishment for our children. So we'll get to that conversation in a few. But first, covering racist statements by public officials, Steve King, the always controversial, seemingly Iowa Republican, not just controversial, but quite frankly, he's been characterized as being a white nationalist and a racist, and his statements support that accusation, I would argue. He was at it again over the weekend, supporting comments by a racist anti-immigrant politician, a Dutch white nationalist, Geert Wilders, I believe is how his last name is pronounced, via Twitter. So we wanted to talk about what the media's responsibility is in covering racist statements. And should racist statements by public officials be given airtime? Should they be given the opportunity to spew their views when they are racist, overtly racist, or maybe not overtly racist, but racist, should they be given an opportunity to spew those views? It's a really interesting and important question, especially in the age of politics that we find ourselves in now. In the studio with me is Professor Lamont Summers, assistant professor of media ethics and law and media ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Professor, thank you for joining us outside of your usual purview of the Media Report.
Well, glad to be here. Glad to be here, as always.
Yeah, appreciate you taking time and hanging back for a minute to help us out. And also, we have on the phone our friend Charles Robinson, veteran reporter for Maryland Public Television and State Circle. Charles, thank you for talking to us as well.
Glad to be here, Sean.
Professor Summers, I want to start with you. So what King said ultimately in this tweet, he says Wilders, referring to this Dutch white nationalist, Wilders understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization. I'm going to repeat that. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. So what King was talking about, non-white people, non-Western people. This is, like I said, this has been par for the course for Steve King. He's been engaged in this narrative of white nationalist and racist and racism really since 2003. That's not simply my opinion. I mean, this is the conclusion of many people who have watched King, politicians and non-politicians alike. He was the same man who said that, you know, some of the immigrants or illegal immigrants that have crossed the border from Mexico, some of them were probably nice kids, but said also, this is what he said. He said, some children brought to the U.S. illegally were good kids. There were others who, quote, who weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert. That's just one example of some of the rhetoric that King has spewed over the years. So the question is, Professor Summers, why does Steve King have a right? Why is he given an opportunity? Why is he given a platform on the public airwaves, specifically in mainstream media airwaves, to spew this type of rhetoric? It seems clear to me that we've had ample examples to know what Steve King is all about. How come he's not ostracized like David Duke is? How come he's not ridiculed and torn into, really? I guess is how I would characterize it. Remember Tim Russert, how he attacked David Duke and really destroyed him on the air on Meet the Press when Russert was alive, rest his soul. How come Steve King keeps having these opportunities to spew these statements over and over again?
Well, first of all, he's a public official. Right. And as an elected public official, certainly he's going to say things that hopefully he's going to say things that are going to be of interest to his constituents and to the country at large. But these racist, xenophobic, white supremacist, white nationalist statements that he's made over the years, I think it's important that the news media does give him coverage and exposes him for what he is, and then let the criticism and the response and the counter responses and the reaction occur. I think what's interesting, however, is the reaction. What's the reaction of the Republican Party? Mm. What are McConnell and the president, Ryan, et cetera? Right. What are they saying in response to what King is saying? So I think that certainly, he is a public official. The things that he says, I think it reflects on his character, his fitness to be and to serve in that office. And I think it's also a reflection on his constituents, the people who voted for him.
Right.
So I think it's important that the statements that he make are given the fullest kind of attention. Now, the second question you asked about what kind of response should mainstream media in particular give? Right. And I think that response should be unflinching. It should be forceful. And I think it should clearly show him and show the views that he's representing as being reprehensible. But they have to do it. Mainstream media has to do it in a way that presents, you know, both sides or presents all various viewpoints, unless you're dealing with advocacy journalism.
I understand.
And that's another story.
Of course it is. It is. Charles, I'm going to come to you in a moment. But first, what I want to do is play one sound clip from an exchange between King and Chris Cuomo of CNN. King was being interviewed by Cuomo this morning. Then, Charles, I'll come to you after we have listened
to
that sound.
You wrote that Wilders understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. We cannot restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. This is being condemned by many regions of American politics and citizenry. What did you mean?
Well, of course, I meant exactly what I said, as it always is the case, Chris. And to expand on that a little further, I've been to Europe and I've spoken on this issue, and I've said the same thing as far as 10 years ago to the German people and to any population of people that is a declining population that isn't willing to have enough babies to reproduce themselves. And I've said to them, you cannot rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies. You've got to keep your birth rate up, and that you need to teach your children your values. And in doing so, then you can grow your population and you can strengthen your culture, you can strengthen your way of life.
Who's somebody else's babies?
Chris, We're a country here that, you know, if you take a picture of what America looks like, you can do it in a football stadium or a basketball court, and you see all kinds of different Americans there. Mm. We're pretty proud of that the different looking Americans that are still Americans. And there's an American culture, an American civilization. It's raised within these children in these American homes. And that's one of the reasons why we require that the President of the United States be raised with an American experience.
I mean, because it seemed like you were doing the opposite. Like you were trying to say someone else's babies means you're either white or you're not right. And as you know, that is anathema to what America's all about. Can we get agreement on that?
Well, here's actually, if you go down the road a few generations or maybe centuries with the intermarriage, I'd like to see an America that's just so homogenous that we look a lot the same from that perspective. I think there's been far too much focus on race, especially in the last 8 years, and I want to see that put behind us, and I want to be as bonded together. I gave a speech on this on Saturday, and half the liberals got up and left the room when I talked about
because
the
when
success
you say,
and unity
when you suggest
and putting an end
anybody,
to the divisions.
But when
they're
you
looking
suggest,
for hatred is the point, Chris.
But hold on a second. Congressman, if you suggest that somebody else's babies shouldn't be welcome in a country, you seem inherently divisive. That's why I keep asking you, what was your intention with this? And you keep to seem doubling down on it. I mean, you said America's got lots of different faces, that's fine, but you keep making this point that this country needs to be about white people raising their birth rate and not bringing in other people.
That speaks for itself. I mean, you don't need an assessment from me or a description from me to identify what Steve King is. Anybody who listens to that, who can objectively or with any sort of sense of specifically the history of this country, the history of race, the history of white nationalist thought, Charles Robinson, we know what that is. We hear it. I mean, that's Aryan talk, quite frankly. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. But let me ask you, as a reporter, Charles, a veteran reporter, what is our role? What's our responsibility in confronting people like Steve King outside of the parameters of advocacy journalism, which I endeavor in, obviously? But what is the role of a straight journalist like you in covering people like Steve King?
I want to talk about three areas. First and foremost, I want to talk about the role of the black press, yep, if you will. I want to also talk about the role of journalists as it relates to how do you deal with these kind of things. And the last part of that is the role of that other type of journalism, so-called advocacy journalism, on the conservative side, and how they're perceiving some of this. So let me talk about the black advocacy journalists. First and foremost, we've dealt with this before. We've dealt with this when it came to Jim Crow laws and, of course, lynchings and so forth. And I think it's been pretty established and clear that we're just not going to let this go by with a pass. Right. And that's important because what you have to do is you have to shine a light on darkness. And if you can do that, I think that the black community of all the communities of color in this country know all too well how people will spin who you are and why you exist. And that's part of that narrative. Now, let me talk about what I think a lot of people call the mainstream journalism, or folks who are trying to do objective journalism. I don't even call it mainstream journalism, who are trying to do objective journalism. Okay. First and foremost, it is not our role as reporters to point this out. And in this case, probably the strongest person to come out against Stephen King was Representative John Lewis. Lewis has been the subject of King's vitriol before. It is not the first time. And he clearly called him what he was. He was a racist. He was being racist in his statements and how that impacts. But remind yourself, in many instances, Lewis is preaching to the choir. He is not outside of right, what I would call the judicial. Now, let me talk about my conservative colleagues who believe that Steve King is on to something. I don't necessarily agree with that concept, but I know from talking to them that it is, in their belief, these are unseen and unforeseen circumstances that will dwarf them by 2020 when the population of the United States becomes browner. And They fear that. And they fear that with an intensity that gave rise to a Donald Trump.
Understood.
And then they aren't listening to you, Sean.
No, I know. That's okay.
And they are listening to their own choir that sees this attack. If you notice, King suggested, why do we have to keep talking about race? And this idea that I think John Roberts, in one of his opinion, the way to stop racism is to what? To stop talking about
right.
it. I'm sorry, I'm not feeling that. And you know, I think it comes down to an issue of humanity.
Right.
And that's really what this is about.
Got it. We got to keep going. We don't have a lot of time.
Sure, I'm sorry about
that's
that.
That's okay. Let me play. This is what we're gonna. I want to play another segment of that interview with Chris Cuomo, because I think that he confronts him in the vigorous way, Professor Summers, that you suggest. Let's play that, and I'll talk to you on the other side of that.
Not, but Chris, I never have made that point. I've never said that. I've been characterized as saying that. I've had the blogs out there say I said that, but I tell them, go back and watch the tape, listen to it, just listen to the language. Our language is precise. That's not out there. But this is an effort on the left, I think, to break down the American civilization and the American culture and turn it into something entirely different. I'm a champion for Western civilization, and yes, our English language is a big part of it. It's a carrier of freedom.
Right.
Wherever the English language has gone globally, freedom went with it.
I just want to just go back at this one more time, just because it's that important. A Muslim American, an Italian American, a Christian American, a Jewish American, you do realize that they are all equal, right? They are all the same thing. We don't need babies from one of those groups more than we need them from other groups. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would say that it depends.
Why do you
on
pause
the
on a question like
families.
That, Congressman? What do you mean? It doesn't depend on any definition.
Because
you're either an American
you
or you're not.
Objective answer, Chris.
Yeah, but either
simple.
A Muslim American, an Italian American, an Irish, Scotch, German American, which is what your roots are, either those are all equal things or they are not. What is your answer?
They contribute differently to our culture and civilization. There are moderate Muslims that are equal to in all these categories.
I said
that you
a Muslim
there
American.
Are there are
people
others,
who have
Chris,
lived here who are assimilated.
In their families.
Yeah, but there are a lot of
if
people teaching hatred in their families who are white,
I think
who
they
are
can
Irish,
assimilate.
Who are Italian, who are Muslim. A lot of people preach hate. There's hate in a lot of different groups.
So that, again, an exchange between Representative King of Iowa and Chris Cuomo of CNN. Professor Summers, I mean, I think Cuomo handled it as vigorously as he possibly could without, you know, going down a different path. I think one of the things that I'm lamenting here is that I have not seen that level of vigor in interviewing King too many times outside of Chris Cuomo. I think that some people were actually not beyond the realm of the professional journalists. Some people were so taken aback by Steve King's views that they almost seemed panicked. But I think the point that we're trying to make here, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this issue, is that these views in the age of the 45th president of the United States are becoming more and more apparent, and they are being brought forward in a public forum. And so this is a new challenge for media.
Yes, I would agree. And I think there's a fear that these kind of views could become part of the mainstream.
Right.
And then how do you if you take a view that say 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago was certainly on the fringes,
right,
or you would not have a Steve King or somebody
there
like
that.
There was
only David Duke out there.
Yeah, David Duke and people of his ilk. And so now you see more and more people. You see congressmen.
Right, a member of Congress.
You see members of Congress actually willing to come out and appear on media outlets and state these views and be quite forceful with them. So I think I hear you're saying is that where is the equal counter response,
right,
from news media? Many years ago, many decades ago, there was a distinguished journalist named Edward R. Murrow.
Of course.
And in fact, 63 years ago, I think last week, he actually confronted Senator, the late Senator Joseph McCarthy, and in his program, the CBS program See It Now.
Right.
And it was that program that is being credited by historians as being the one thing that really took Joseph McCarthy down, that really unmasked him. But before that, there was a lot of attention. There was a lot of criticism waged at the press at that time that how could Joseph McCarthy get as big as he did? Mm. Where was the press? Why was the press not so critical at that time? And I think we're at a similar period. Even though we have all these media outlets, I think we still need a much more forceful response by media, especially by news journalists, with regard to Stephen King and people like him.
Right. We don't have a lot of time left. I want to take two quick phone calls, and I need my callers to be quick, 1 minute or less, please. Erica from Baltimore, you're on First Edition.
Can I turn the radio down, please? Yes, good afternoon. My name is Araka Rotheron-Jew, an empowerment specialist in Baltimore. I have two quick points. The first is, why are we continuing to behave with incredulity, like this is something shocking and new and must be addressed? The idea that the United States of America was really founded on homogenous, white racist is actually factual.
We so understand, this, right.
This vision of America has no foundation in historical fact. In rhetoric, yes, but not in fact.
Right.
The second piece is, if we talk about stopping them spewing white nationalist rhetoric, that also means we are not going to be allowed to discuss black nationalism. And I would invoke the First Amendment of the United States, which entitles any American to speak his or her piece freely and without censorship. Thank you.
Let's go to Donna next in Baltimore. Donna, you're on. Whoa, Donna just hung up. Sorry about that. We're actually out of time, just about. To be continued, but go ahead.
Well, I would like to say I'm not in favor of censorship. I'm certainly
not
suggesting censorship.
Right.
You know, I do think he ought to be covered and he ought to be.
It's how do we deal with
critique?
It's
how
not
do you,
about
exactly.
shutting him up. It's like
I think it's exposure. I think that's part of what you have to do. You have to show the incredulity, if you will, of what he said, and I'm hoping that better angels will see the fallacy in what he was saying.
I don't know if angels is the word I want to use when dealing with the media or Steve King, quite frankly, unfortunately, Charles. But this conversation will be continued, of course. Charles Robinson is a reporter for Maryland Public Television State Circle. Charles, always a pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Lamont Summers is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Professor Summers, thanks for hanging out with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Stacey Patton. Wrote an opinion piece that appeared in the New York Times titled "Stop Beating Black Children." We'll talk to her coming up after the break. Stay tuned. Here on WEAA 88.9, as we make the transition from Steve King, the Iowa representative, and his comments to an op-ed piece in the New York Times that appeared over the weekend by Dr. Stacey Patton. She's an award-winning journalist, author, child advocate, and assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at Morgan State University. Her new book, Spare the Kids, Why Whooping Children Won't Save Black America, is being released on March 21 from Beacon Press. Dr. Patton, thank you for joining us. We appreciate you taking time to talk to us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So, I read your entire piece, and I mean, all of us, any black person of a certain age, can identify with what you write about, and specifically, at the beginning of your piece, you talk about your personal experience, very personal experience, mm-hmm. with being disciplined physically by a foster parent.
My adoptive mother.
Adoptive mother. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Very poignantly written, but painful to read. I remember as a kid, I didn't have the exact same experience. I didn't get beat a lot as a kid, thank God. But 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 I remember the experience of I remember just the threat of grandparents or parents saying, "I'm gonna get a switch. You're gonna go get your own switch off of a tree." And we say it with some, you know, as we reflect back on it, with some, I don't know, it's a humorous thing. But there were children, and I suspect you were one of them, who it's not humorous when we think about the level of discipline, physical discipline that we received. Why did you think it was important to write this book and to specific and obviously write the pen this opinion piece for the New York Times?
Well, it's something that I've thought about ever since I moved into my adoptive parents' home when I was 5 years old. From the very first time she ever, you know, popped me in the mouth, my entire world felt like it came crushing down, because this was an adult who was supposed to love me and keep me safe, and I was supposed to trust her. And so as I got older, the whippings escalated and it eventually funneled me into the foster care system. And while I was in the foster care system, I saw so many young people, particularly Black children, who had been intellectually, physically, spiritually, psychologically destroyed by that kind of aggressive child-rearing practice. And as I've done my professional advocacy work and also studied the historical roots of this issue, I've come to learn how this parenting practice intersects with so many other challenges in our communities, from the school-to-prison pipeline, the racial disparities in foster care and fatalities of Black children, to the violence that we see in certain cities like Baltimore and Chicago. This is a public health issue, and this is why I wrote the book and also decided to pen the piece in the New York Times.
So, and I want to come back to that, some of the historical evidence and pure evidence that you bring forward in your article, and I believe in your book as well, as far as the correlation between this type of discipline and our history of slavery in this country. But first, I want to ask you, what has been the reaction to your, the piece in the New York Times? I'm sure it's been a lot, or am I off base here?
No, I've been writing about this issue in various publications for years, and each time it's pretty much the same. I've heard all these arguments before, from spare the rod, spoil the child, to there's a difference between spanking a child and beating a child, to white people saying, how dare you blame white people for Black child abuse. But then on the other side, it's been very positive. There's been quite a number of people on both sides of the color line writing to say thank you, to share their own personal experiences of having gotten corporal punishment as a child. So the piece was validating to them. I've heard from a lot of school teachers who say thank you because they often have to deal with students in classrooms where they're hit at home, but then they come to class and they, express challenging behavior in the classroom, intellectual deficits, aggressive behavior, and so on and so forth. What I'm happy about is that the level of conversation is there. When I was a kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, there wasn't this conversation. I mean, people were barely grappling with domestic violence against women back then, let alone talking about child beatings. So I'm happy to actually see people grappling with the subject. And social media has driven a lot of that conversation.
Sure. I want to speak, drill down a little bit more specifically on the experience that children have when they are hit. Regardless of whether it is a tap on, you know, a swat on the legs, or a slap in the mouth, or a, or being hit with an object, whether it be a switch, a belt. I mean, I've known kids who've been beaten badly in my as when I was a young boy, and the feeling of but the belittlement, the disregard, the just I mean, that feeling when you when you're doing what kids do, and the response from a parent or a loved one or someone who's watching you, or who's supposed to, as you said so eloquently, who's supposed to be taking care of you and loving you, that physical, there's something that happens, I think, in the head and the spirit of a kid when that happens. Can you just talk about that a little bit more? Because obviously you have that very specific experience.
Yes, I think what you say is very important. What happens is a lot of people, when they become adults, they say they're grateful for the whoopings that they got. That they say things like, I'm the man I am, or the woman I am today, or I'm not in jail, I'm not dead, I'm not in prison because somebody whooped me. And anybody who was hit as a kid and grows up to say that, it's actually a sign of brain damage. And I'm not saying that to be disrespectful to people, but there's 50 years worth of science that shows that people who are spanked, and I'm not talking about, you know, the really, really abusive stuff, the extension cords, right, switches and all that. I'm talking about regular spankings on the backside. There's a Harvard psychiatrist who has studied brain scans for about 20 years, and he found that people who were spanked generally have about 30% less gray matter in the prefrontal cortex of their brain. This is the area of the brain that you need for emotional regulation, executive function, and also memory. So people can't even remember the pain, the fear, the distrust, the sense of betrayal that they felt when they were actually children experiencing the pain and the fear. So what they've done is they've grown up to invert the pain as something that was good, that kept them out of jail, as if they were destined for that anyway. And I always argue if whippings were so, you know, useful at keeping black people out of jail, then we'd be having no conversations about mass incarceration.
Or about 300 homicides each year in the black community.
Exactly. And so people always say, well, there's a difference between spanking a kid and beating a kid, but a child's body does not process the pain differently just because you call it one thing or another.
Right.
It's all violence, and it all involves hitting. It all involves pain, and it all potentially puts kids at risk for the same negative karma. And so we don't, you know, think about this from the child's perspective. You ask any kid, I bet you if you put 50 children in a room and ask them what's the difference between a spanking and a whooping, they won't be able to tell you. Ask them, well, which one hurts worse, you know, they might be able to tell you, well, it's different being beaten with a switch versus an extension cord versus somebody slapping you upside the head. But at the end of the day, it's still pain.
Right, right. You write in your New York Times piece, quote, between 2006 and 2015, more than 3,600 black children were killed as a result of maltreatment, according to the Administration for Children and Families. That's an average of 360 children a year, three times higher, I'm going to repeat that, three times higher than for other racial and ethnic groups. Many social workers and district attorneys I have talked to say it is not malicious parents intentionally hurting their kids who end up with convictions for child abuse or homicide. It is those who started spanking and escalated as the child got bigger. So as the child gets bigger, the parents don't turn to alternatives to disciplining or instructing their children. They just get more violent. Is that what you're saying here?
Yes, and sometimes it's just, and I've read a lot of these case files, a parent who's in a moment of frustration or even rage can go too far. They can hit a little too hard and in the wrong place, where a child gets hit and falls and hits their head on something.
Right.
So any parent who is spanking their kid is actually putting their child at risk for child abuse or that hit ending in a fatality. You hear the words of parents oftentimes say, I didn't mean to hit him that hard or her that hard.
Right.
I didn't mean to do it. And so it's not, people think that when a kid is severely abused or killed, that it's these sadistic people who starve kids and torture them. That's not the case. Most often it's actually parents who spank. They usually spank as a disciplinary tactic, And that one time, they went too far.
All right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. I'm on the phone with Dr. Stacey Patton. She's an award-winning journalist, author, child advocate, and assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at Morgan State University. Her new book, Spare the Kids, Why Whooping Children Won't Save Black America, is being released on March 21st from Beacon Press. She penned an opinion piece in the New York Times that appeared in the Sunday section, I believe, over the weekend. Professor Patton, I want to take a phone call real quick. Let's go to Merrick in East Baltimore. Merrick, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
I'm well. How y'all doing today?
I'm all right.
Granted, I understand what Dr. Patton was talking about. I do, having worked child protection when I was in New York, it was crazy. But what I'm very concerned about is, one, the demonization of black parents who are literally trying to save their kids from mass incarceration, all of those things, and they think spanking is going to do it because they don't know another way. And two, the proactive approach in teaching adults in our community to discipline our children in a holistic, healthy way. I don't think that it is helpful to demonize people who are literally trying to help their children, and also taking into account that we have learned these behaviors through the enslavement and Jim Crow. This is part of the continual dehumanization of African people. So how do we proactively teach people how to discipline their children in nonviolent ways, but not demonize them in the process?
Merrick, thank you so much for that question. Very important. Dr. Patton, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, she raised some great questions, really, really good questions. And this is what I try to do with my book. My book comes from a place of love. It is to say that, listen, while whipping children might be a prevalent practice in black communities, it is not intuitive to our culture. It's not native to us. And I go all the way back to West Africa. Actually, I say, in order to understand current patterns of discipline in black communities, you have to go back 2,000 years of European history to see how white people were sadistically treating their own children, exploiting them, raping them, killing them in high numbers. And they fought these traumas along with greed and racism and genocide and disease and a whole bunch of other things to this continent, to everywhere else they colonized. And that treatment of their own children, of white people's own children, got meted out and applied to Africans who they considered civilizational children, people who never grew up, people who were savage. And so it's during that process of the Middle Passage experience, centuries of slavery, and the Jim Crow period as well, that this type of parenting practice, leading your kid to save them from harsher consequences at the hands of an overseer, or the Ku Klux Klan, or the Knight Riders, or the police who basically replaced the Klan and lynch mobs. This was something that got implanted into our culture. So I say, listen, black people, first we got to figure out where this practice came from. We got to look at what we did before contact with white people, how we regarded our children as gods, as sacred, as mystical, as powerful, right? And how that changed when slavery turned our children into chattel, to be a barter, to be brutalized and worked to death. And so once we understand first the historical roots of this practice and where it came from, then that's step one. And then we have to look at the ways in which our culture, within our culture, we reify all of this, whether it's preachers who preach toxic, you know, a toxic, bastardized form of Christianity, spare the rod, spoil the child, whether it's our comedians who joke about whipping kids, our radio hosts who joke about whipping kids. We have to look at all of this and then educate parents about the consequences from a scientific perspective. So what I tell black folks is, I know you love your children. That's not a question. sometimes we lack the historical understanding, the roots of the understanding of the historical roots and the cultural logic behind this, and how it is damaging to our children's physical, intellectual, and psychological development, how it's connected to what happens in the and what you know, how we sort of extend the lash. We have to do that kind of education and then give alternatives. It's not about demonizing parents at all.
Right. Professor Patton, your phone is kind of going in and out. I want to ask you a quick question, though, while we kind of find the signal, the correct signal. It sounds to me as if your book, you personally embrace a more authentic, holistic approach. And when I say authentic, I mean going back some time, obviously, to a pure, for lack of a better term, Afrocentric approach to how we raise our children. Am I stating it correctly?
Well, I don't. It could be. You could interpret it as Afrocentric. But the reality is that slavery and Jim Crow created a new kind of black people, African Americans. What I'm saying is that we have to reject, like vehemently reject, everything that this Eurocentric society has taught us about ourselves. We have to reject the toxic Christianity. People are still going to be Christians, but we have to interrogate some of that stuff, and develop a nonviolent approach to raising our kids. We have to listen to the science that tells us that this type of child rearing practice is not good in terms of children's intellectual development, in terms of their psychological well-being. So we have to start embracing another way. We've been whipping children since the plantation, and it hasn't helped our communities at all.
I'm going to read more from your opinion piece in the New York Times, Dr. Patton. You say, quote, "The truth is that white supremacy has done a masterful job of getting black people to continue its trauma work and call it love. That is how in some 19 states, mostly in the South, you can get so many black parents to sign opt-in forms giving public school teachers permission to paddle their kids with wooden boards, even though black students are 5 times more likely to be hit than white students for committing the same offenses." I remember as a kid in nursery school and elementary school, like in the first grade, being paddled. Let me be clear. I don't reflect back on getting paddled by teachers as a good time. I don't reflect back on it and saying that saved me from anything. The devil is a liar. I'll say it that way. It didn't save me from nothing.
Not today, Satan.
No, for real. I mean, it didn't save me from anything. I thank God that I did not get physically disciplined a lot as a kid, and I didn't. That argument doesn't seem to hold water. Let me take some phone calls, Dr. Patton. People want to get into the conversation. Mm-hmm, we don't have a lot of time left. Let's go to Aaron in East Baltimore first. Aaron, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
All right, brother.
Well, now, there are folk who would say, what are you supposed to do when the child acts up?
Yeah, people would say that. Dr. Patton, what is your answer to that? I mean, that's a common question.
And yep, it is a common question. First, I encourage listeners to visit my website, www.sparethekids.com. You will find all kinds of tips and information to talk about child development issues and ways that you handle everyday things, from how to teach a child not to touch a hot stove without smacking them, to eating vegetables, to doing homework, and so on and so forth. We just launched a site over the weekend. We've had thousands of visitors come over, just 5,000 visitors in 48 hours, so that people are really hungry for alternatives. We live in the age of Google, You can Google just about anything, any question on how to do something different. A lot of times I hear people say, well, what are you supposed to do? But a lot of times that comes from a place of frustration.
Absolutely.
And
but it's an inherent challenge. That question in and of itself is really kind of the ubiquitous challenge in disciplining our children. And then, I mean, what are we supposed to do? I mean, wow. I mean, listen to how that sounds.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and the idea that you can't hit a child to get them to do what you want them to do is really frustrating to a lot of folks.
Right.
And I always say, again, you know, it's part of the problem is that people lack the ability to see their children as people separate from themselves.
Right.
And people lack information about child development issues, so they have unreasonable expectations for what they want their children to do.
Well, and to that point, I mean, it's not reasonable if we're in a work situation and your coworker's getting on your nerves, you can't punch them in their face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, that's because you know, people hit kids because kids can't hit themselves.
Right.
And I think a lot of people get angry when I say you shouldn't hit kids. Because the fact is, it's the only real power they have in their lives.
Mm. Wow.
And you take that away from them, and you say, well, where do I have authority? Where do I have authority in this world? Who do I have power over?
Wow.
You mean I got to think creatively? You mean I have to respect a child? And you have a lot of parents who parent from a place of the ego.
Mm.
You know,
wow.
Like you want to smack a child around because a child rolls their eyes or sucks their teeth. Well, that's pretty African. I wrote a piece about that, how that's an African. You ever watch an African movie? All you hear is teeth sucking.
Right.
People rolling their eyes. That's African.
Yes,
and it got beaten out of us and considered disrespect on the plantation. And here we are in the year 2017, still threatening to smack kids for rolling their eyes and sucking their teeth, for doing something that is intuitively African.
Right. Let me take one more phone call, Dr. Patton. Let's go to Teresa in Pasadena. Teresa, you're on First
Edition.
Hi. Hey.
Basically, my comment is, number one, everybody don't beat their children. Number two, what to me that I'm hearing, that sounds like abuse. Number three, I will still maybe even show my grandchildren the ruler if I have to. And I may even tap their hands or their little behind if I have to. Because when I'm constantly telling them to stop, no, sit down, be quiet or whatever, that means now I'm to a point that I have to show them that I really mean business.
Okay.
So I think what you're really talking about is abuse.
Okay.
And a lot of us know that, yeah, back in my days, I did get a beating with a extension cord. But I know now that, no, I will not do that. I will find strategies and other ways. Amen. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. We just lost.
I will not do that. Okay. I will find strategies and other ways. Amen. Can you hear me?
We got to let Teresa go. Unfortunately, there was some feedback. Go ahead.
See, this is what I'm talking about. You know, the continuing trying to parse out degrees of violence. So, I go back to the research that shows even spanking a child or threatening them. See, what parents don't see is when you hit a child, even if you smack them on the hand, what you see is the child crying. What you don't see is the biochemical responses that you set off in that child's body, cortisol, oxytocin, and other hormones that a body goes through when they experience fear. And you keep doing this over time, what it does to a child's developing brain is that it alters the physical architecture of the brain, and it sows the seeds for a low IQ, more aggressive behavior, and so on and so forth. And what the basic message that you're teaching a child is to get somebody to do what you want them to do, to control them, is to, you know, you use violence, you hit them, you use aggressive behaviors. And then we wonder why our kids go to school and they act up, they're aggressive in the classroom, or they end up growing up and coming out into the streets and handling situations with guns and knives later on, or they beat their wives or their spouses later on. So it's not just this, well, what kind, a lot of these parents will say, well, there's a difference between spanking and abuse. I don't do that. I don't beat with switches. But what you're still saying is my kind of violence is the good kind.
Mm. Right. A really important conversation, Dr. Patton. Fascinating. Your opinion piece in the New York Times appeared over the weekend. Stop Beating Black Children. Dr. Stacey Patton is an award-winning journalist, author, child advocate, and assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at Morgan State University. Her new book, Spare the Kids, Why Whooping Children Won't Save Black America, is being released on March 21st from Beacon Press. Dr. Patton, thank you so much for talking to us today. We appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having this conversation. It's a really important one. Glad to be on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition, we'll talk to a young man, Chase Turner. He's a graphic designer and creative strategist of I Chase Art LLC, talking about branding. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.